Usually we think of a classic piece of art as this, pristine, meticulously planned masterpiece.
Right, like it's completely untouchable.
Exactly. The assumption is that some genius just sat down in a quiet room, was struck by a singular vision, and executed it flawlessly.
Which is almost never how it actually happens.
Never. But what if I told you that one of the most famous Broadway musicals in history, I mean, Cole Porter's Anything Goes, was actually this frantic duct tape survival operation?
Born out of literal desperation.
Yeah, an international fugitive's desperation.
It completely shatters that illusion of the quiet genius in a room, doesn't it?
It really does. Welcome to today's deep dive, by the way.
Yes, welcome. Today we're looking at a pretty comprehensive stack of Wikipedia excerpts covering the 90-year legacy of this 1934 show.
And the deeper you look into these sources, the more you realize you are looking at a beautiful catastrophe.
A catastrophe that somehow managed to conquer the world.
So that is our mission for you today. We are going to uncover how a musical born out of financial desperation, hastily rewritten due to a real-life maritime tragedy, somehow became this constantly mutating 90-year pop culture juggernaut.
It's quite the ride. Oh, and you can see my visual backdrop has already changed for this.
Oh, wow, yes. A gorgeous 1930s Art Deco ocean liner. Very glamorous.
It is stunning, but don't let the shiny veneer fool you because the origins of this ship are incredibly messy.
Okay, let's unpack this. How messy are we talking?
Well, to truly understand the madcap energy of the show, you have to look at the sheer panic that built it.
Panic is, honestly the perfect word. The origin story is just wild.
It really is.
So the producer, Vinton Friedley, he comes up with a concept for a musical set on an ocean liner while he is literally living on a boat.
Right, and he's not on a luxury vacation.
No, he has fled the United States to dodge his creditors.
It's so funny to think about. I compare Friedley to like a desperate modern day tech CEO,
Oh, totally.
brainstorming a pivot while hiding out in a non-extradition country.
Just frantically trying to save his skin.
Exactly. But in 1934, he literally vanished into international waters. No cell phones, no digital footprint.
Just hiding on a boat.
Right. And he realizes his only ticket back to dry land and out of financial ruin is a massive Broadway hit.
So he pulls together this absolute dream team.
Yeah.
P.G. Wodehouse and Guy Bolton to write the script, Cole Porter doing music and lyrics, and Ethel Merman to star.
On paper, it's bulletproof.
Totally bulletproof. But the original script they wrote was actually a dark comedy, right?
Yeah, it featured a bomb threat and a shipwreck.
Which became a huge problem.
A horrific problem. Just weeks before opening, a real passenger ship, the SS Morro Castle, caught fire off the coast.
Oh, man.
Yeah, 138 people died.
Just a completely sobering reality.
Yeah.
You can't put on a breezy musical comedy about a disaster at sea after that.
Not at all. Friedley had to scrap the plot entirely.
Weeks before opening.
Exactly. And the original writers were stuck in England.
So he basically grabs his director, Howard Lindsay, and a press agent, Russell Crouse, and just throws them into the fire to write a new book.
Which brings up a really fascinating historical discrepancy in the sources.
Oh, right. Why did he really change it?
Exactly. Did Friedley change it purely out of tasteful respect for the victims?
That's the official PR line.
Right. Or, as theater historian Lee Davis claims, was the original script just a, quote, hopeless mess?
I mean, I lean toward the hopeless mess theory.
You do.
Yeah. Because if it was brilliant, wouldn't he just delay the show? But throwing your press agent into the writer's room, that screams desperation.
It really does. So I ask you, the listener, what stands out to you? Imagine the pressure of rewriting a Broadway show weeks before opening night.
It's unthinkable. But that frantic duct-taped rewrite from Lindsay and Krauss is exactly what created the absurd, fast-paced plot we know today.
The farcical engine of the show.
Right. So let's break down the plot they came up with. We're aboard the SS American.
A luxury liner.
Wall Street broker Billy Crocker stows away to win over the heiress Hope Harcourt.
Even though she's engaged to the stuffy British lord Evelyn Oakley.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Billy is getting help from Reno Sweeney, who is this evangelist turned nightclub singer, and a guy named Moonface Martin.
Ah, Moonface.
I was laughing so hard at Moonface's title. He's Public Enemy Number 13.
It's so
It's
specific.
pathetic. He didn't even make the top 10.
Not quite a criminal mastermind.
Right. And then, through this absurd mix-up, the passengers think Billy is actually Snake Eyes Johnson.
Public Enemy Number 1.
Yes, and what is so crazy is that they treat him like a celebrity, Why on earth would high society fawn over a mass murderer?
What's fascinating here is the 1930s context. Lindsay and Krauss brilliantly used this rushed plot to mock high society.
Like Hope's mom, Evangeline, literally forcing her daughter to marry for money.
Exactly, exposing their moral bankruptcy. But they're also satirizing the era's bizarre celebrity worship of gangsters.
Oh, like John Dillinger and Al Capone?
Right. They were treated like folk heroes. The front pages loved them.
So having these wealthy passengers ask a mobster for autographs was this razor-sharp critique.
Totally. And remember, they didn't have time to write deep psychological drama.
No, they had weeks.
So they custom-built these roles for the specific actor's quirks.
Oh, I love this part. Like William Gaxton, who played Billy.
Right. He had a talent for wearing various disguises.
So they just wrote in scenes where Billy steals clothes, he puts on stolen trousers, a jacket, and wait for it, a beard made from a Pomeranian's hair.
It's just pure chaotic vaudeville.
Which totally worked. But here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Because the show was pieced together so quickly, it lacked this definitive, untouchable structure.
Right. It wasn't a sacred text.
Exactly. Which meant that over the next 9 decades, it never actually stopped changing.
Never.
The sources list 5 different librettos. 1934, 1962, 1987, 2011, and 2022.
It's highly unusual for a classic musical.
It's like a software application. You know, it constantly gets patches and version updates to keep running smoothly for modern users.
That is the perfect analogy. And they didn't just tweak the dialogue.
No, they totally adopted this jukebox strategy.
Yeah, taking songs from Cole Porter's wider catalog.
Like they grafted in Take Me Back to Manhattan from The New Yorkers.
Uh-huh.
And It's DeLovely from Red Hot and Blue, plus Friendship from DeBerry Was a Lady.
They just surgically implanted these hits.
But how does that even work structurally?
Well, this matters because Porter's songs were modular by design. They were witty observations about love or society, not bogged down in heavy plot exposition.
So you can just drop It's DeLovely wherever two people are falling in love.
Exactly. It kept the show culturally relevant. And they even reassigned who sang what.
Oh, yeah, like The Gypsy and Me.
Right. In 1987, they gave that song to Lord Evelyn instead of Hope.
Which is brilliant. It highlights his suppressed wild side.
It transforms him from a boring obstacle into a guy with a hidden freak flag.
It makes his connection with Reno makes so much more sense. Most classic musicals are treated like museums, but anything goes is treated like a playground.
Absolutely. But when a show is constantly shifting its script and score like that, it relies heavily on the sheer magnetism of its lead actors to anchor it.
Totally. The gravitational pull of the stars.
Especially the role of Reno Sweeney. She's become this Mount Rushmore of musical theater divas.
The roster of legends who have played her is staggering.
It really is.
You start with Ethel Merman, who originated Reno in 1934.
The human trumpet herself.
Exactly. And she played her on TV in 1954, allegedly clashing with her co-star, Frank Sinatra.
Oil and water, those two.
I can only imagine. But then you jump to Patti LuPone in the massive 1987 Lincoln Center revival.
Which fundamentally changed the sound of the show.
Yeah, they brought in the 16-piece Benny Goodman-style swing band and put them right on stage.
And LuPone had the vocal grit to match that massive wall of sound.
Incredible. And then Elaine Page bringing it to London in 1989.
Also legendary.
But let's talk about the modern era. Sutton Foster's dominance in the 2011 revival.
Oh, she brought such a muscular athleticism to it.
She won a Tony for it. And then her triumphant return in the 2021 London revival.
Right. She stepped in at the last minute for an injured Megan Mullally.
Literally flying across the ocean to save the show.
Talk about returning to the frantic origins of the musical.
Oh, seriously.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, these performances translated into massive critical success.
Oh, tons of awards.
Right. Racking up Tony and Olivier Awards for Best Revival across multiple decades. The show's resilience isn't just in the writing.
No, it's a vehicle.
Exactly. A vehicle that allows generational talents to completely redefine the material for their era.
So why should you, the listener, care about a 90-year-old musical today?
That's the big question.
It's because it is the ultimate masterclass in adaptability. I mean, it was born from a creator running from the law.
Hiding on a boat.
Forced to pivot due to a horrific tragedy.
Literally weeks before opening.
And it survived by happily cannibalizing its own creator's songbook to stay fresh.
Patching the software, as you said.
Exactly. It proves that sometimes the best art doesn't come from perfect planning.
No, it comes from improvising through the chaos.
Which is such an inspiring takeaway.
It is. But you know, looking at all this leaves us with one last really provocative thing to ponder.
Oh, lay it on me.
So we've established that over 90 years, the script has been entirely rewritten 5 times. The songs have been swapped out for tracks from completely different shows.
Radically change.
And the characters have shifted their fundamental motivations. So it raises an incredible philosophical question.
Okay.
Like the Ship of Theseus. If you replace all the parts of Anything Goes, at what point does it cease to be the 1934 musical and instead become something entirely new wearing a vintage mask?